Hello, and welcome to Field Lab Earth, the podcast that's all about past and present advances in the fields of agronomic, crop, soil, and environmental sciences. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Ebony Morell and Dr. Mac Burgess about their paper, Achieving Diverse Cover Crop Mixtures, Effects of Planting Date and Seeding Rate, published in Agronomy Journal. I'm your host, Abby Morrison. Let's talk about science. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to get to record with you guys today. So just to start, why don't you both tell me a little bit about yourselves, how you came to your science, and what you're doing professionally.
Okay, this is Ebony speaking. I received my PhD in biology from Illinois State University, and I came to agroecology through an indirect route. So I did grow up in Illinois in a farm town and was sort of surrounded by agriculture, but really didn't have a good grasp of the diverse nature of agriculture, having only seen one type of it. So I originally got my PhD in mosquito ecology, and it wasn't really until I did a postdoc at University of Wisconsin-Madison in organic agriculture that I really became enthralled with the idea that there are so many more diverse practices out there than I was previously aware of. From there, I did some organic research on different types of fertilization and its effect on crop growth and insect pests in Wisconsin. And then from there, I went to work for Penn State University with the Cover Crops Mixtures Group, part of whose work we'll be talking about today. From there, I now have just started a job at the Land Institute in Kansas, where I'll be continuing to work with effects of crop diversity on ecosystem services and its effect in turn on pest management in agricultural systems.
And Mac, why don't you give us a little background on you?
Yeah, so this is Mac Burgess. I grew up in the inland desert of Southern California, where if you had water, you could grow things in all sorts of unusual times of the year compared to most of the rest of the country. And then over the years, I've gardened and I've farmed in Northern California and Southern Ohio and in Montana and in Central Pennsylvania. And it's really been fascinating to play around with the timing of planting crops when your objective isn't necessarily to harvest a grain crop off those crops. So plants that we think of as cash crops like wheat and canola and rye can be grown for just a part of their life cycle all sorts of different times of the year, and it really depends on where you are and how much water and time with appropriate temperature you have. You can have all sorts of interesting outcomes and quite a lot of diversity. So that's been a fascinating thing for me for quite a long time. My doctoral research at Montana State University, we were trying to grow cover crops in replacement of the summer fallow phase of the summer fallow winter wheat crop rotation that's common in the northern plains. And here the limitation on crop growth is the amount of water present. It's interesting to note that in the east, in the corn growing parts of the country, one of the purposes of cover crops is to use excess water from the soil to prevent some of the environmental consequences of water leaching nutrients out of the soil.
Thank you for sharing that about yourselves. Can you tell me a little bit more just about cover crops in general, kind of what they're used for, when they're planted, just a high-level overview of what they do?
I'll take a stab at this, Mac, if you don't mind, and then if you want to restate everything in probably a more professional context, you can correct me, you can do so.
We'll see. So
cover crops, very broadly speaking, are a crop species or a set of species that are planted in the rotation in between your cash crops. The purpose of the cover crop is typically not to be harvested for any sort of economic gain. Having said that, there are some farmers who do graze their cover crops or will harvest them for forage for their cattle, but that's about as commercial as it gets. Otherwise, the purpose of the cover crop, as the name implies, is to keep the soil covered. Originally, cover crops were employed because of their ability to prevent soil erosion. In recent years, farmers have quickly come to realize that cover crops can provide a lot more services than simply keeping the soil in place. Depending on what kind of cover crop species you plant, they can provide a lot of different services.
Sure, and Mac, you had a good analogy for these, I understand.
I think the sports team analogy maybe is a good one. Members of a cover crop mixture are like players on a football team. Each one has their own strength, their own ability to perform certain tasks or achieve certain ecosystem services, but it takes a team to pull off a victory in the field or to obtain the best mixture of services.
Sure. Can you give some examples of the ecosystem services you were looking at for this paper specifically?
Sure. So some cover crop species are capable of fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere, so making nitrogen in the air that's not available to plants available to plants. Other cover crops might specialize in taking up nitrogen from the soil and thereby preventing its loss. Some of our cover crop species are beneficial to pollinators by virtue of their flowers. One of our big cover crop species is cereal rye, so it's one of the most winter hardy and aggressive growing plants in the spring, but it maintains a fairly low profile in the fall, allowing other plants like, say, radishes to grow around it and above it.
Since you're not harvesting them to sell, do you just leave them and just let them rot? Do you till them in? Does it matter according to what field you're in or environment?
That's an excellent question. They can be terminated in a few different ways. If you plant a cover crop that is not frost tolerant, then the winter naturally kills it. So some farmers will specifically choose crops that are winter kill because they're just easy to terminate. They basically terminate themselves by freezing in the winter. Other times, if you plant a cover crop that is winter hardy, farmers can terminate it in the spring either by spraying it. If it's a conventional field, they can spray it with an herbicide to kill it. What the organic farmers will do will be to sometimes mow it, and after they've mowed it, they'll till it in. So by tilling in that cover crop residue, the leftover plants, then that provides a lot of really good organic matter, some green manure, if you will.
I guess I might add that especially for smaller farmers who maybe don't have large tractors or heavy-duty tillage equipment, terminating cover crops in the spring can be a challenge, and so the matter of timing of when to attempt to kill a cover crop in the spring can be important.
Sure. Tell me a little bit about the high-level question or problem that you hope to address in this paper.
Sure. So we had several questions regarding planting cover crop monocultures versus planting cover crop mixtures. So it's relatively easy to plant a cover crop monoculture. It isn't even as hard if you move from one to two species. When you start moving up into multiple species, that's when it becomes a whole different ballgame. Some species complement each other very nicely. Others don't grow very well in mixtures, or if they do grow in mixtures, the amount of seed that you put into the ground doesn't necessarily turn into the amount of biomass of that species that you want. That can create two different problems. One is that farmers don't want to pay for seed that's not going to grow. So it doesn't make sense to put a species in your mixture that you have to plant a whole lot of seed in order to get anything of that species to grow. And if it does grow, then it doesn't grow very well. So that's not an ideal situation. The other problem with that is that you get the most services, the most ecosystem services out of any kind of plant mixture if the species in those mixture are fairly evenly represented. So what we wanted to investigate with this project was how do we get good representation of cover crop mixtures, and what affects whether you get nice even representation of cover crops species within mixtures. So how do the seeding rates affect that? How do the combinations of species affect that? How does planting date affect that? Can you get successful mixtures planted successfully after corn versus planted after wheat? Because if you're planting a cover crop after corn, that's going to be planting it much later in the fall, and that cover crop then has less time to grow before winter comes.
Mac, did you have anything to add on any of that?
Farmers and the seed industry have been promoting diverse cover crop mixtures or cocktails for some time now in different parts of the country. And there's been an assumption that with regards to diversity, more is better. So there are 3, 4, 6, 12, even 14 species cover crop mixtures being promoted. And one of the questions that we had is, how much diversity is enough? Is it sufficient to say, well, we have essentially 2 or 3 functional groups worth of plants, and if I can find one that fits well in my system that represents that functional group, maybe 3 species is going to get you 95% of the benefits, and all those additional different kinds of seed aren't necessary. Or maybe they do add something. So that was one of the things that we wanted to investigate, was different levels of diversity. So we have some 3 species cover crops mixtures that are specifically designed to target certain functions. We had a 4 species mixture that adds a species that flowers in the spring with the idea of benefiting pollinators. Then we threw everything we had into the bucket with a 6 species mixture, and then we had another mixture that was even more diverse with different kinds of clover and some other grass types in it as well.
It kind of sounds like an art form, or like cooking, you know, where once you just keep throwing in every flavor you've got, eventually it just is not really tastes like anything.
Yeah.
And then one concept I think I would add to that is that any given mixture of seed that you put in the ground, some or all the plants might thrive in one given environment, so one year in one location, but go to a different location or even a different year in the same place and a different mixture of plants may emerge from that same diverse seeding. So there's myriad reasons a single player on the team might not do well that year, to continue the sports analogy, but maybe at another place or another time it would. So in some sense, diversity builds you resilience against unpredictable conditions that might occur over the years in a certain location. And so maybe this year the radishes didn't do well, but other years they do. That's an important thing to consider, and that's one of the reasons this project was repeated for 3 years.
Sure. So let's move on then to some of the more specifics of how you went about doing your research. Tell me a little bit more about the specific cover crops that you were using for this experiment.
Certainly. So within the experiment, we did have a fallow treatment where no cover crop was planted. So that was our baseline. And then we had 6 individual species that we planted as monocultures. So our 6 players, if you will. One was canola, which is a winter hardy brassica that flowers in the spring and can provide pollinator resources. Another one was forage radish, which is a brassica. Unlike canola, forage radish tends to grow very quickly in the fall and then it frost kills. The advantage to radish is that it has a much thicker taproot, so radish can be very good for breaking up compaction. Cereal rye is a very hardy grass. Cereal rye is, in fact, the most common cover crop, I would say. And the reason that cereal rye is so popular is not only is it cheap, but it's very hardy. It grows not too quickly in the fall, but it establishes, and then over winters and in the spring, it'll very rapidly put on biomass. It's very flexible in that you can plant it very late in the fall. And it provides excellent weed control by having a fibrous root system. Another thing that cereal rye does very well is it will take up excess nitrogen that might be in the soil and prevent it from leaching. Oats was another cover crop that we used. It's a grass like cereal rye. Unlike cereal rye, it puts on biomass very rapidly in the fall and then winter kills. It provides the functions of being a good weed suppressor as well as taking up excess nitrogen from the soil. Red clover was one of the legumes that we used. Red clover is actually a perennial crop, but in this case we planted it as if it was an annual crop. Red clover does not grow as quickly as some of the other legumes, but it is very winter hardy, so that allows it to provide nitrogen through nitrogen fixation in both the fall and the spring. The last species was Austrian winter pea, which is a legume. It can be variable in its ability to survive the winter. When it does survive, it can put on a massive amount of biomass, and in doing so, it fixes a lot of nitrogen and can be extremely beneficial. From those 6 monocultures, we created a series of mixtures. One was a three-species nitrogen mix, which when planted before corn, contained both of our legumes, red clover and Austrian winter pea, and then had a little bit of cereal rye in it so that any excess nitrogen that was leaching through the soil could be taken up by the cereal rye, but the primary purpose of the mixture was to provide nitrogen through the nitrogen fixation in the legumes. Another mixture that we planted was a three-species weed management mix, and that consisted of, I believe it was cereal rye, radish, and red clover. So there, the red clover was there, again, to provide a little bit of nitrogen fixation, but the main purpose of the management mix was to help to suppress weeds. We then had a four-species mix, which consisted of canola, cereal rye, red clover, and Austrian winter pea. So the reason we included two legumes in that mix was more or less an insurance policy. We knew that the Austrian winter pea was going to be our primary nitrogen-fixing legume, but we went ahead and added red clover, so in the event that Austrian winter pea died, the red clover would still be there in the spring. The other two species in the mixture, cereal rye, was providing its normal services. And then we had canola as our brassica to also assist with weed suppression and nitrogen uptake. But canola has the benefit of flowering in the spring, so it could provide extra resources and habitat for beneficial insects. And then the last mixture that we had was a six-species mixture where it was all six of the species that we had in monoculture thrown together in a single mix. And the idea behind that was to test this idea that Mac brought up of redundancy.
Mac, can you tell us a little bit more about how the rates or ratios of the seeds were chosen for this then?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about this research project is that we had a large degree of farmer involvement. So we convened a advisory panel consisting of farmers, industry, so seed industry representatives, and academics. And we all sat down at a table, and we started with the recommended seeding rates for each of these crops and monocultures. And as we increased the number of species in each mixture, we started off by trying to think of them proportionally on a plant population basis. So with a three-species mixture, you might start off with each of the species at one-third of its normal planting rate. But then we modified that after some considerable amount of debate and discussion with this diverse group of people who together had quite a lot of experience in observing the interactions of these plants together in different kinds of mixtures. So in some cases, we increased the rye seeding rate when we wanted weed suppression, or decreased it if we were afraid that it would absolutely dominate the other crops in the mixture. And that was where some of the more interesting results came about, is rye is the most dominant crop in all those mixtures where it occurs, and having less rye seed doesn't necessarily make for less rye biomass in the spring, but having a larger diversity of other things in the mix does allow for some more expression of the benefits from those other crops in the spring.
Sure. That's awesome. I had no idea that you had this council of wise elders to help you with this project. That's so fascinating to me. I love learning about how scientists kind of do that kind of thing. Let's move on to the results of your research. What did you find when you planted all of these mixtures?
Well, let's see. So one of the things that we found was that cover crops mixtures that were planted later in the season, after corn silage in October, they really didn't overwinter well. By the spring, those mixtures had basically become monocultures of cereal rye. So the takeaway point from that was, if you want to plant a cover crop later in the fall, you may be better off planting a monoculture of something hardy like cereal rye, or a really hardy biculture, than trying to plant one of these really diverse mixtures. In the mixtures that we planted in August after wheat, we found that most of them were still fairly diverse by spring, although cereal rye was still pretty dominant in those mixtures, and that was despite the fact that we had dialed back the seeding rate of cereal rye. The most even mixture that we achieved was actually the four species mix of red clover, Austrian winter pea, cereal rye, and canola. And that was even more diverse than the six species. So planting a diverse mixture in August will give you a fairly diverse mixture in the spring. Just maybe cut down on the amount of cereal rye you put in the mixture, or we suggest planting a less aggressive grass than cereal rye. Another thing that we found, and this really fascinated me, was there was an advantage to planting Austrian winter pea in mixtures as opposed to monocultures. So as I mentioned earlier, Austrian winter pea can sometimes winter kill depending on the conditions. There are a couple of reasons why we think it might winter kill. One of the reasons is that if you plant it too early in the fall or in late summer, then Austrian winter pea will really grow aggressively, put on a lot of biomass, and it will start to flower and create reproductive structures. And once it goes into reproductive mode, it's really not in a good physiological state to overwinter. By planting it in a mixture, that actually reduces the amount of growth that Austrian winter pea puts on in the fall, and therefore it's in a better physiological state to survive the winter. Another reason we suspected why planting Austrian winter pea in a mixture might be better than in a monoculture is because Austrian winter pea, when it successfully overwinters, it's usually because there's some kind of snow cover to protect it from really harsh conditions. If it's planted in a mixture, then it has vegetation of other species surrounding it, and that might provide a covering effect, a protective effect on the Austrian winter pea that it wouldn't necessarily get if it was planted in monoculture. We don't exactly know which one of those, or if both of those might be the reason for Austrian winter pea surviving the winter more predictably in mixtures than in monocultures, but that was nevertheless a result that I was excited to see.
That's awesome. So tell me about what the next steps are for the research related to this, or kind of some areas of future research you guys see with this.
So there were several takeaway lessons from this study that we took to heart and have tried to work with going forward. One of the things that I brought up was the dominance of cereal rye in these mixtures. And to address that dominance, one of the things Penn State Cover Crop Research Group has done has been to replace cereal rye with triticale, which is a cross between wheat and cereal rye, which provides all of the same services as cereal rye, but it's a much less aggressively growing grass. So that seems to have done quite a bit better in these mixtures going forward. It still, again, provides all of the services, but then we don't have to worry about it overgrowing and growing out of control in the spring. Another thing that we took away from this research is that we want to try to promote cover crop mixtures in organic farming on a wider scale. And it was very useful to see that this four species mixture that we designed had done very well, was able to provide a fairly even representation of species, provide most of the services that we wanted it to provide. And so our next step in research has been to recruit 8 organic farmers throughout the state of Pennsylvania and New York. And we are planting a modified version of that four species mixture across all of those farms in order to evaluate how different farming practices at different latitudes with different soil types can affect the growth of that mixture and the functions it performs. Another thing that I think is important to point out from this research is that we looked at 6 different cover crop species and mixtures of those 6 different species. Of course, those are not the only 6 species that are planted as cover crops. There are dozens of species that are used or could potentially be used as cover crop species. And another thing that I think would be useful to address from here is how do different cover crop types work together. So we know how individual species work together, but there are so many different combinations that you could look at. You know, even if you were just doing simple grass, brassica, legume combinations, which team players play best together in different parts of the country? And I don't think there's any one good answer to that. I think, as Mac pointed out earlier, the growing conditions are vastly different in parts of the country. Different individual cover crop species will do better depending on different growing conditions. And so I think it's important for future research to continue to look at combinations of these functional groups of species and try to determine which mixtures might work best for different parts of the country.
Sure. And are you working on that much with your work at the Land Institute, or are you kind of shifting away from that?
We do some cover cropping at the Land Institute. One of the things that we're particularly interested in is expanding this research looking at cover crop mixtures, where you're interseeding or you're mixing together these different species that play off one another and form ecosystem services. We would like to pick that up and actually take it into a cash crop agricultural context. So in that case, we are working primarily with perennial species, alfalfa, as well as perennial species that we're domesticating to develop perennial grains. And we are interested in interseeding those different groups. So for example, we could have a perennial sunflower interseeded with alfalfa, interseeded with a grain grass, in order to get at providing these same kind of ecosystem services that are currently being provided in these annual rotations with cover crop mixtures.
Well, that sounds delightful. I have three questions left for you guys. So the first one is, if people want to learn more about cover crops and the research you guys are doing, where can they go to get more information?
I encourage people to visit the Penn State Cover Crop Cocktails research site for information about the research they're doing, as well as extension articles that they've published for guidelines on how to plant cover crop mixtures in the Northeast United States. Within the Midwest, the Practical Farmers of Iowa has done a great amount of research on planting cover crops in the Midwest, so that would be very useful there. And the thing I love about Practical Farmers of Iowa is that a lot of their research is farmer-led. A lot of information about simply cover crops, how to plant them, how to get them to survive, what species work best in an area. A lot of that information is coming from the farmers. And so having that resource available so that farmers are teaching each other and learning from each other on how to plant cover crop mixtures is just a fantastic model. NRCS, in a general context, NRCS is a great national resource for cover crops. They are a big proponent of planting both monocultures and mixtures in the United States, and they have conservation grants available for people who are interested in planting cover crops.
As far as resources go, I would also add the Midwest Cover Crops Council has a cover crop species selection tool, which helps you to understand the possibilities. Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program, or SARE, has a book available online as a PDF called Managing Cover Crops Profitably, and it's got a great introduction to 30 or 40 plus different species, their suitability for different times of the year in different parts of the country, and some insight into how to manage them and how they might play together in mixtures. But cover crop mixtures are something that can be designed specifically for each location and cropping systems context, and there's room for all sorts of creativity.
Excellent. We've got two more questions for you. So the first one is, if people want to help with this, either the research or promoting the use of cover crops, how can they get involved?
Well, I would say one of the ways that if people wish to get involved is to plant cover crops themselves. Don't be shy at trying different types of cover crops and seeing what benefits they might provide. Cover crops are something that aren't just planted in large row crop fields. They can be planted in gardens at home. They are often used in vegetable rotations. So cover cropping is just a great tool for not only keeping soil and organic matter in place, but helping to improve your soil over time. If somebody is a farmer and has been doing cover cropping for a while, I encourage you to share your ideas with other farmers as well as your regional extension agent. I do believe that this is a field where farmer participation is not only good but essential to trying to figure out what mixtures work best. There are a lot of farmers out there who have been working with cover crop mixtures for years on their farm, just tinkering around with different combinations that work very well. And one of the things that I found in doing the on-farm research that we've started in the last year or two is that some of these farmer mixtures work just as well as the mixture that we're planting on their farms. Sometimes those mixtures work even better, and sometimes they work just as well, but they're more economical to put together than the mixture that we've devised. So I think farmer participation in helping to design and promote cover crop mixtures is really essential to increasing the use of cover crop mixtures in multiple locations.
Yeah, I would encourage people to be bold. Go for it. Plant something outside of the normal time frame for its growth. Nature abhors a vacuum, and if you try to have one, she'll give you a bunch of weeds, but if you throw some extra seeds in, you might be surprised with what you see. Even out here in Montana, where I live now, I see some really interesting success stories with August-sown cover crops, where we have irrigation to support the growth of them, both in vegetable production systems, but also there's a really interesting example in the Beaverhead County area in Montana, where quite a lot of producers are planting a mixture of peas and turnips and oats after barley harvest and using some irrigation to get that going and providing a great grazing resource for the cattle in that part of the state. Think outside of the box, and whenever there's water and suitable growing conditions that are going to last for more than 6 weeks or so, see what you can do. Plant some plants.
Sure. All right. Final question, guys. Perhaps the most important question of them all. What is one thing people would not know about you if all they had was your research?
I like writing geeky song parodies. Especially science-related song parodies. So look out, YouTube. You may see me there one day.
Can you give me an example of one of the parodies you did?
Oh, goodness. So I'm working on one right now called Entomology Number 5 that's based on Mambo Number 5, only it's the chorus describes the different orders of insects and little ways to remember them.
Wow. Is that a teaching resource or just because
partly
you love it?
Both.
Okay. That's wonderful. Mac, how about you?
Well, I pride myself on knowing what's out there in the agricultural world, so I do a lot of driving around, and I even teach a class in crop identification where we don't go for drives, but we talk about how you might identify crops through the windshield at 55 or 75 miles an hour, depending on where you are. But I was stumped recently. We were driving in a rural area in north central Montana, and there was an irrigated field of a crop, and I couldn't tell what it was, and I had to pull over and stop, and my students were laughing at me for pulling over and being stumped on crop identification, and that was something I would have to stop the vehicle for. And we rolled the window down, and it was immediately apparent that what we were seeing was a field of dill distilled into dill oil for flavoring pickles and potato chips and who knows what else. But I'd never seen a field of dill, and it sure was fragrant. But
I'll bet, yeah.
Wasn't obvious what it was from the road.
What makes it hard to identify it through the windshield? Just distortions or dirt on the glass?
In retrospect, it should have been easy. It's just not something you ever see a field of, you know, blooming dill on the 100-acre scale. So it wasn't in my mind as a possibility. But it looked vaguely like canola, but clearly wasn't canola. And, you know, what else would have big yellow flowers and tall plants at that time of year? It completely had me stumped until we opened the window.
Well, thank you guys so much for your time. I really appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy schedules to talk to me.
Sure.
Thank you for listening to Field Lab Earth. If you'd like to find out more about today's topic, our featured article for this episode will be freely available for the next 2 weeks. You'll find a link to today's paper and other resources for this episode in our show notes or on our website. If you have any questions, comments, or recommendations for show topics, please contact us at podcast@sciencesocieties.org or on Twitter @FieldLabEarth. If you'd like to hear more content like this, please subscribe, and don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes or anywhere else you find your podcast if you like our show.
This podcast is a joint production of the Tri-Societies, the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, and Soil Science Society of America. Special thanks to Lobo Loco for the use of their song Spook Castle on the intro and outro of our show. Opinions and conclusions expressed by authors are their own and are not considered as those of the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, Soil Science Society of America, its staff, its members, or its advertisers.